I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Bestseller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Section 38 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2 by Mandel Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 7, War Between the Popes and the Council, 1436 to 1438, Part 3. Though Roky Khanna stayed in Prague, he was systematically set aside in ecclesiastical matters. On April 12th, Bishop Philibert appointed rural deans throughout Bohemia and charged them how to carry out their duties. Roky Khanna was not even consulted. The church in which Roky Khanna preached was given to the rector of the university, who was inducted by the legate. Peter Paine was banished by Sigismund from Bohemia as a heretic, and an opportunity against Roky Khanna was eagerly looked for. This was given by a sermon preached on May 5th about the communion of children, in which he said that to give up this practice would be a confession of previous error and of present instability of purpose. Too many now condemn what once they praised, but you, poor children, lament. What have you done amiss that you should be deprived of the communion? Who will answer for you? Who will defend you? Now no one heeds. Mothers lifted their voices and wept over the wrongs of their children, and that was judged sufficient to establish against Roky Khanna a charge of inciting the people to sedition. The Diet demanded that some steps should be taken to administer the Archbishopric of Prague, and Sigismund's influence with the moderate party was strong enough to obtain on June 11th the election of Christian of Prakotic to the office of vicar of the Archbishopric. Roky Khanna, on being asked to surrender the seal and submit to Christian as his spiritual superior, judged it wise to flee from Prague, June 16, 1437. The exile of Roky Khanna was the triumph of the moderate party, the Utraquists, pure and simple, who wished for entire union with the church, but who were still staunch in upholding the principles of a reformed church for Bohemia. Envoys were sent off to Basel to end the work of reconciliation and settle the points which still were disputed. On August 18th, the envoys, chief amongst whom were the priests John Prebram and Procopius of Pilsen, entered Basel with great magnificence. Prebram, in his first speech to the council, demanded that the communion under both kinds should be fully granted, not only in Bohemia and Moravia, but universally, seeing that it was the truth of God's law. Prebram and John of Palamar argued learnedly for many days on the subject, but Prebram felt that he met with little attention from the council. One day he angrily met the suspicious coolness which surrounded him by declaring that the Bohemians had never been heretical, but had always remained in the unity of the faith. If anyone said otherwise, they were ready to answer with their steel, as they had done in past days. When Prebram had ended his disputation, Procopius of Pilsen advocated the communion of children with no better success. At last, on October 20, 1437, the Bohemians submitted 9 demands to the council, which deserve mention as showing the ultimate point arrived at by these long negotiations. 1. That the communion under both kinds be granted to Bohemia and Moravia. 2. That the council declare this concession to be more than a mere permission given for the purpose of avoiding further mischief. 3. That the Church of Prague be provided with an archbishop and 2 suffragans, who should be approved by the realm. 4. That the council issue letters clearing the good name of Bohemia. 5. That in deciding whether the communion under both kinds be of necessary precept or not, the council adhere to the authorities mentioned in the Compact of Eger, the law of God, the practice of Christ and the apostles, general councils and doctors founded on the law of God. 6. That the communion of children be allowed. 7. That at least the epistle, gospel, and creed in the mass service be said in the vulgar tongue. 8. That the University of Prague be reformed and have some prebends and benefices attached to it. 9. That the council proceed to the effectual reformation of the church and head and members. Prebramba sought that these be granted, especially the gospel truth concerning the sacrament. The kingdom of Bohemia is ready, he added, as experience has shown, to defend and assert this even by thousands of deaths. Great was the indignation of the Bohemians when, on November 6th, Cesarini exhorted them to conform to the ritual of the universal church as regarded the communion of the laity under one kind only. Still, he added, the council was willing to stand by the compacts. Cesarini had gone too far in thus openly showing the policy of the council to reduce the Bohemians to accept again the Catholic ritual. It required some management on the part of other members of the council to allay their indignation. On November 24th, the council gave a formal answer to the Bohemian requests. As regarded the necessity of the communion under both kinds, the point had now been argued fully. It only remained for them to join with the council and accept its declaration on the subject as inspired by the Holy Ghost. Their other points had either been already settled by the compacts or were favors which might afterwards be discussed by the council. This was, of course, equivalent to a refusal to grant anything beyond the bare letter of the compacts. The Bohemian moderates saw themselves entirely deceived in their hopes of obtaining universal tolerance for their beliefs. The council would grant nothing more than a special favor to Bohemia and Moravia to continue to use the ritual which they had adopted until such time as it could be safely prohibited. In vain the Bohemians asked that at least they should not be sent away entirely empty-handed, lest it be a cause of fresh disturbances. They could get no better answer and left Basel on November 29th. In spite of Cesarini's remonstrance against the imprudence of such a step, the council on December 23rd issued a decree that the communion under both kinds was not a precept of Christ, but the church could order the method of its reception as reverence and the salvation of the faithful seemed to require. The custom of communicating under one kind only has been reasonably introduced by the church and was to be regarded as the law, nor might it be changed without the church's authority. In Bohemia, the disappointment of the expectations which the great mass of the people still retained caused growing irritation and seemed likely to lead to a fresh outbreak. Moreover, Sigismund's declining health gave an occasion to the ambitious schemes of those of his own household. Sigismund had no son, but his only daughter was married to Albert of Austria, and the fondest wish of Sigismund's declining years was that Albert should succeed to all his dignities and possessions. But the Empress Barbara had already tasted the sweets of power and was unwilling to retire into obscurity. She and her relatives, the Counts of Sely, raised up a party among the Bohemian barons with the object of elevating Ladislaus of Poland to the thrones of Bohemia and Hungary, and marrying him, though still a youth, to Barbara in her 54th year. Sigismund discovered this plot and felt the danger of his position. He was seized with erysipelas and had to submit to the amputation of his big toe. His one desire was to quit Bohemia and secure Albert's succession in Hungary. Concealing his knowledge of what was passing around him, he left Prague on November 11th, borne in an open litter and dressed in the imperial robes. He was accompanied by the Empress and the Count of Sely, and on November 21st reached Znoimo, where Albert and his wife Elizabeth awaited him. There he ordered Barbara to be imprisoned, but the Count of Sely had timely warning and escaped. At Znoimo, Sigismund summoned to his presence several of the chief barons of Bohemia and Hungary, and urged on them the advantages to be gained by uniting both lands under one rule. He warmly recommended to their support the claims of Albert. This was his last effort. Feeling his malady grow worse, he was true to the last to that love of dramatic effect which was so strong a feature of his character. He wished to die like an emperor. Attired in the imperial robes with his crown on his head, he heard Mass on the morning of December 9th. When Mass was over, he ordered grave clothes to be put over the imperial vesture, and sitting on his throne awaited death, which overtook him in the evening. He was left seated for 3 days according to his command, that men might see that the Lord of all the world was dead and gone. Then his corpse was carried to Grosswardein and buried in the resting place of the Hungarian kings. The facile pen of Aeneas Sylvius gives us the following vigorous description of Sigismund. He was tall, with bright eyes, broad forehead, pleasantly rosy cheeks, and a long, thick beard. He had a large mind and formed many plans, but was changeable. He was witty in conversation, given to wine and women, and thousands of love intrigues are laid to his charge. He was prone to anger, but ready to forgive. He could not keep his money, but spent it lavishly. He made more promises than he kept and often deceived. These words are a fair representation of the impression produced on his contemporaries by this mighty lord of all the world. With all his faults, and they were many, on the whole men loved and esteemed him. No doubt vanity was the leading feature of Sigismund's character, but it was the dignified vanity of always seeming to act worthily of his high position. He would have been ludicrous with his dramatic strut had not his geniality and keenness of wit imposed on those who came in his way, and so saved him from hopeless absurdity. It is easy to mock at Sigismund's undertakings, at his pretensions as compared with the results which he achieved, but it is impossible not to feel some sympathy even for the weaknesses of an emperor who strove to realize the waning idea of the empire, and whose labors were honestly directed to the promotion of the peace and union of Christendom. Sigismund possessed in perfection all the lesser arts of sovereignty. Kindly, affable, and ready in speech, he could hold his own amidst any surroundings. His schemes, however chimerical they might seem, were founded on a large sympathy with the desires and needs of Europe as a whole. He labored for the unity of Christendom, the restoration of European peace, and the reformation of the Church. Even when he spoke of combining Europe in a crusade against the Turks, his aim, however chimerical, was proved by the result to be right. But Sigismund had not the patience nor the wisdom to begin his work from the beginning. He had not the self-restraint to husband his resources, to undertake first the small questions which concerned the kingdoms under his immediate sway, to aim only at one object at a time, and secure each step before advancing to the next. Relying on his position, he caught at every occasion of displaying his own importance, and his vanity led him to trust that he would succeed by means of empty display. Hence, his plans hampered one another. He destroyed his position at the Council of Constance by a change of political attitude resulting from a futile attempt to bring about peace between England and France. He induced Bohemia to think that its religious interests were safe in his keeping, and then trusted to repress its religious movement by the help of the Council of Constance. When he had driven Bohemia to revolt, he oscillated between a policy of conciliation and one of repression, till matters had passed beyond his control. He lost his command of the Council of Basel because he entered into relations with the Pope, who was bent upon its overthrow. His schemes of ecclesiastical reform slipped from his grasp, and after spending his early years in extinguishing one schism, he lived to see the beginning of another. Few men with such wise plans and such good intentions have so conspicuously failed. The death of Sigismund removed the only man who might have averted an open outbreak between Eugenius IV and the Council of Basel. Both sides now proceeded to extremities. On December 30th, Eugenius IV published a bull declaring the council to be transferred from Basel to Ferrara. At Basel, Cesarini made one last attempt to bring back peace to the distracted church. On December 20th, in an eloquent speech, breathing the true spirit of Christian statesmanship, he pointed out the evils that would follow from a schism. Farewell to all hopes of a real union with the Greeks, of real missionary enterprise against the Mohammedans, who were the serious danger to Christendom. He besought the council, ere it was too late, to recall its admonition to the Pope, provided he would recall his translation of the council. Then let them send envoys to meet the Greeks on their arrival in Italy, and propose to them to come to Basel, Avignon, or Savoy. Failing that, let them frankly join with the Pope and the Greeks in the choice of a place which would suit all parties. He offered himself as ready to do his utmost to mediate for such a result. But Cesarini spoke to deaf ears. The control of the council had passed entirely into the hands of Cardinal d'Allemont, who was committed to a policy of war to the bitter end. A ponderous reply to Cesarini was prepared by the Archbishop of Palermo, a mass of juristic subtleties which dealt with everything except the great point at issue. Cesarini saw the entire disappointment of the hopes which 6 years before had been so strong in his breast at the opening of the council. He had longed for peace and reform. He saw instead discord and self-seeking. The council, which ought to have promoted the welfare of Christendom, had become an engine of political attack upon the papacy. The noble, generous, and large-minded aims of Cesarini had long been forgotten at Basel. The reformation which he projected had passed into revolution, which he could no longer control nor moderate. He shared the fate of many other reformers at many times of the world's history. The movement which he had awakened passed into violent hands, and the end of his labors for peace and order was anarchy and discord. With a sad heart he confessed his failure, and on January 9th, 1438, he left Basel amid demonstrations of respect from his opponents. At the request of the Pope and all the cardinals, he went to Florence, where he was received with honor and lived for a time in quietness and study. At Basel, Cardinal d'Allemont was appointed president in Cesarini's stead. The council on January 24th took the next step in its process against Eugenius IV. It decreed that as he had not appeared to plead within the appointed time, he was thenceforth suspended from his office. Meanwhile, the administration of the papacy belonged to the council, and all acts done by Eugenius were null and void. 16 bishops were present at this session, of whom 9 were Savoyards, 6 Aragonese, and 1 Frenchman. Of the 18 abbots who were there, 11 were Aragonese and 6 were Savoyards. The council was, in fact, supported only by the King of Aragon and the Dukes of Milan and Savoy. The Duke of Savoy hoped to use it for his personal aggrandizement. The King of Aragon and the Duke of Milan saw in it a means of forcing Eugenius IV into subserviency to their political schemes in Italy. Neither of them was prepared to support the deposition of the Pope, but they wished the process against him to be a perpetual threat hanging over his head. The rest of the European powers looked with disapproval, more or less strongly expressed, on the proceedings of the council. Henry VI of England wrote a letter addressed to the congregation, not the council, of Basel, in which he reproved them for presuming to judge the Pope, denounced them for bringing back the times of Antichrist, and bade them desist from the process against Eugenius. Charles VII of France wrote to the council to stay its measures against the Pope, and wrote to the Pope to withdraw his decrees against the council. He forbade his bishops to attend the council of Ferrara, but allowed individuals to act as they pleased at Basel. His purpose was to regulate ecclesiastical matters in France at his own pleasure. In Germany, Sigismund's policy of mediation survived after his death. Men wished to avoid a schism, but to obtain through the council some measures of reform. The kings of Castile and Portugal and the Duke of Burgundy all admonished the council to withdraw from their proceedings against Eugenius. The quarrel of the Pope and the council now ceased to attract the attention of Europe. It had degenerated into a squabble in which both parties were regarded with something approaching contempt. But this condition of affairs was full of danger to the future of the organization of the Church. End of section 38. Section 39 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 8. Eugenius IV in Florence. The Union of the Greek Church, 1434 to 1439. Part 1. Since his flight from Rome in 1434, Eugenius IV has merely appeared as offering such resistance as he could to the growing pretensions of the council. During the 4 years that had passed from that time, he had been quietly gaining strength and importance in Italy. True to her old traditions, Florence graciously received the exiled Pope, and under the shadow of her protection, Eugenius IV, like his predecessor Martin V, had been able to recruit his shattered forces and again re-establish his political position. At first his evil genius seemed still to pursue Eugenius IV, and he played a somewhat ignominious part in Florentine affairs. The time when he arrived in Florence was a great crisis in Florentine history. The prudent conduct of Giovanni de' Medici had preserved the internal peace of Florence by carefully maintaining a balance between the aristocratic and popular parties in the city. But between his son Cosimo and his political rival Rinaldo degli Albizzi, a bitter hostility gradually grew up, which could only end in the supremacy of the one or the other party. The first step was taken by Rinaldo, who, in September 1433, filled the city with his adherents. Cosimo was taken unawares, was accused of treason, cast into prison, and only by a skillful use of his money succeeded in escaping death. He went as an exile to Venice, but his partisans were strong in Florence, the city was divided, and a reaction in his favor set in. It was clear that the new magistrates who came into office on September 1, 1434, would recall him from banishment, and Rinaldo and his party were prepared to offer forcible resistance. On September 26th, Florence was in a ferment, and Rinaldo degli Albizzi, with 800 armed men, held the palace of the Podestà and the streets which led to the piazza. Eugenius IV, in this condition of affairs, offered his services as mediator. He sent Giovanni Vitaleschi, Bishop of Recanati, to Rinaldo, who, to the surprise of everyone, was persuaded to leave his position and confer with the Pope at Santa Maria Novella. It was 1 o'clock in the morning when he did so. What arguments the Pope may have used we do not know, but at 5 o'clock Rinaldo dismissed his armed men and remained peaceably with the Pope. Perhaps he was not sure of the fidelity of his adherents, and trusted that by a show of submission he might, with the Pope's help, obtain better terms than the doubtful chances of a conflict seemed to promise. His enemies at once pursued the advantage thus offered to them. The Signori sent some of their number to thank the Pope for his good offices, and whatever may have been the first intention of Eugenius IV, he was soon won over to abandon Rinaldo. On October 2nd, the party of the Medici filled the piazza and decreed the recall of Cosimo. Next day, Rinaldo and his son were banished. The Pope attempted to console Rinaldo and protested the uprightness of his own intentions and the pain which he felt at the failure of his mediation. "Holy Father," answered Rinaldo, "I do not wonder at my ruin. I blame myself for believing that you, who have been driven out of your own country, could keep me in mine. He who trusts a priest's word is like a blind man without a guide." Sadly, Rinaldo left Florence forever, and on October 6th, Cosimo de' Medici returned in triumph amid shouts that hailed him father of his country. From that day forward, for 300 years, the fortunes of Florence were identified with those of the House of Medici. In his abode at Florence, things gradually began to take a better turn for Eugenius IV. The rebellious Romans, who had proudly sent their envoys to Basel, announcing that they had recovered their liberties and that the days of Brutus had returned, began to find themselves in straits. The papal troops still held the castle of St. Angelo and bombarded the town. Their commander, also by a stratagem, took prisoners several of the Roman leaders. The people soon turned to thoughts of peace and submission, and on October 28th, Giovanni Vitaleschi, at the head of the Pope's condottieri, took possession of the city in the Pope's name and put to death the chief leaders of the rebellion. Moreover, Venice and the Pope renewed their league against the Duke of Milan, appointed Francesco Sforza as their general, and sent him against the Duke's condottieri general, Fortebraccio, who had occupied the neighborhood of Rome. Fortebraccio was routed and slain, whereon the Duke of Milan found it advisable to come to terms. On August 10, 1435, peace was made, leaving Eugenius IV master of the patrimony of St. Peter and the Romagna, while Francesco Sforza obtained the lordship of the March of Ancona. The Duke of Milan also withdrew his aid from the rebellious Bologna, which on September 27th submitted to the Pope. Even in Florence, Eugenius IV was not safe from the machinations of the Duke of Milan. A Roman adventurer named Riccio obtained the connivance of the Milanese ambassador at Florence, the Bishop of Novara, to a plot for seizing the person of Eugenius when he retired into the country before the summer heat. The city magistrates discovered the plot, and Riccio was tortured and put to death. The Bishop of Novara abjectly prayed for pardon from Eugenius, and the Pope granted his life to the entreaty of Cardinal Albergata, who was just setting out as papal legate to the Congress of Arras. Albergata took the Bishop of Novara to Basel, where he remained as one of the bitterest opponents of Eugenius IV. In another quarter, the affairs of the Kingdom of Naples afforded a scope for the activity of Eugenius IV. The feeble Queen Giovanna II continued to the end of her reign to be the puppet of those around her. Even her chief favorite, Caraccioli, could not retain his hold upon her changeful mind. He saw his influence fail before the intrigues of the queen's cousin, the Duchess of Suessa, who at length succeeded in obtaining the queen's permission to proceed against her overweening favorite. On August 17, 1432, Caraccioli celebrated magnificently his son's marriage. In the night, a message was brought to him that the queen was dying and wished to see him. Hurriedly he rose and opened his door to a band of conspirators who rushed upon him and slew him on his bed. Giovanna wept over his death and pardoned those who wrought it. His mighty tomb in the church of San Giovanni Carbonara is worthy of a more heroic character. Three knightly figures of strength, skill, and justice bear the sarcophagus on which stands Caraccioli as a warrior. The tomb is in the vast style of the old Neapolitan work, but in its execution we see the delicacy of Tuscan feeling and the hand of Florentine artists. The way is already prepared for the later flow of the Renaissance motives into the rude regions of Naples. On Caraccioli's death, Louis of Anjou prepared to return to Naples, but the imperious Duchess of Suessa preferred to exercise undivided sway over her feeble mistress. The death of Louis in November 1434 awakened the activity of Alfonso of Aragon, but Giovanna II would not recognize him as her heir and made a will in favor of René, Count of Provence, the younger brother of Louis of Anjou. On February 2, 1435, Giovanna II died at the age of 65, worn out before her time, one of the worst and most incapable of rulers that ever disgraced a throne. On her death, the inevitable strife of the parties of Anjou and Aragon again broke out. René claimed the throne by Giovanna's will. Alfonso of Aragon put forward Giovanna's previous adoption of himself and the claims of the House of Aragon. But Eugenius IV put forth also the claims of the papacy. The Angevin line had originally come to Sicily at the papal summons and had received the kingdom as a papal fief. Eugenius IV asserted that on the failure of the direct line in Giovanna II, the kingdom of Sicily devolved to the Pope. He appointed as his legate to administer the affairs of the kingdom Giovanni Vitelleschi, who had been created Patriarch of Alexandria. Little heed was paid to the Pope's claims. Alfonso's fleet vigorously besieged Gaeta, which was garrisoned by Genoese soldiers to protect their trade during the time of warfare. Genoa, at that time under the seigneury of the Duke of Milan, equipped a fleet to raise the siege of Gaeta, and on August 5th a battle was fought off the Isle of Ponza, in which the Genoese were completely victorious. Alfonso and his two brothers, together with the chief barons of Aragon and Sicily, were taken prisoners. Italy was shaken to its very foundations by the news of this victory, of which the Duke of Milan would reap the fruit. It seemed to give him the means of making himself supreme in Italian politics. But the jealous temper of Filippo Maria Visconti looked with distrust on this signal victory which Genoa had won. His first proceeding was to humble the pride of the city by depriving it of the glory of bringing home in triumph its illustrious captives. He ordered Alfonso and the rest to be sent from Savona to Milan, and on their arrival treated them with courtesy and respect. Alfonso's adventurous and varied life had given him large views of politics and great experience of men. He recognized the gloomy and cautious spirit of Filippo Maria, who loved to form plans in secret, who trusted no one, but used his agents as checks one upon another. In the familiarity of friendly intercourse, Alfonso put before the Duke political considerations founded upon a foresight which was beyond the current conceptions of the day. If René of Anjou, he argued, were to become King of Naples, he would do all he could to open communications with France, and for this purpose to establish the French power in Milan. If I were to become King of Naples, I should have no enemies to dread save the French, and it would be in my interest to live on good terms with Milan, which could at any moment open the way to my foes. The title of king would be mine, but the authority would be yours. With me at Naples, you will remain a free prince. Otherwise, you will be between two strong powers, an object of suspicion and jealousy to both. The state system of Italy was already so highly organized that arguments such as these weighed with the Duke of Milan, and he determined to forego all thoughts of present glory for future safety. Instead of treating Alfonso as a captive, he entered into an alliance with him, gave him his liberty, and ordered Genoa to restore his captured ships. Alfonso was sufficiently keen-sighted to perceive, and Filippo Maria was sufficiently prudent to recognize, the danger that would arise to Italian independence from the centralization of the French monarchy and the power of the House of Austria. They devised a scheme for neutralizing this danger. The idea of a balance of power in Italy, founded on identity of interest between Milan and Naples, which was to keep Italy in peace and exclude all interference from beyond the Alps, began from this time forward to be a central point in Italian politics. The immediate result of this policy was that Genoa, indignant at the slight thus cast upon her, revolted from Milan and joined the League of Florence, Venice, and the Pope. Eugenius IV, alarmed at the alliance between Alfonso and the Duke of Milan, withdrew his own claims on Naples and espoused the cause of René, who was a prisoner of the Duke of Burgundy, but was represented in Naples by his wife, Elizabeth of Lorraine. Neither she nor Alfonso had any resources at their command, and the war was carried on between the rival factions in the realm. We have seen that Alfonso was anxious to minimize the help which the Pope could give his rival by supplying him with sufficient occupation in the affairs proceeding at Basel. When Eugenius IV had recruited his shattered fortunes by an abode of nearly 2 years in Florence, he left it for his own city of Bologna on April 18, 1436. Before his departure, he consecrated the stately Duomo of Florence, which had just received its crowning ornament of Brunelleschi's mighty dome, and was again ready for divine service. The city wished that the ceremonial should be befitting of its splendor. A scaffolding adorned with carpets was erected from Santa Maria Novella to the Duomo, on which Eugenius IV walked in state, the gonfaloniere of the city bearing his train. On April 22nd, Eugenius IV entered Bologna with 9 cardinals and was soon followed by 2 others from Basel. The papal government of Bologna had not been such as to win the affections of the people. The legate, the Bishop of Concordia, had proclaimed a general pacification, on the strength of which Antonio de Bentivogli, after 15 years of exile, returned to the city which he had once ruled. He had not been there 3 weeks when he was seized as he left the chapel where the legate had been saying Mass. He was gagged and immediately beheaded by order of the Pope's Podestà, as was also Tommaso di Zambeccari. The only reason assigned for this treacherous act was dread of the number of their followers. The cruelty and tyranny of the Podestà made the papal rule hateful in the city. Nor did Eugenius IV do anything to mend this state of things. He was busied with his negotiations with the council and with the Greeks. The only attention which he paid to the citizens of Bologna was to extort from them 30,000 ducats, by holding out hopes of summoning his council thither. When the citizens found themselves disappointed, they looked with scarce concealed discontent on the Pope's departure for Ferrara on January 23, 1438. Scarcely had he gone when Niccolò Piccinino, the Duke of Milan's general, appeared before Bologna. On the night of May 20th, the gates were opened to him by the citizens. Faenza, Imola, and Forlì joined in the revolt, and the greater part of Romagna was again lost to the Pope. This was, however, of small moment to Eugenius IV. His attention was entirely fixed on the Council of Ferrara, through which he hoped to win back all that he had lost. The union of the Greek Church was to reinstate the papacy in its position in the eyes of Europe. The Pope was again to appear as the leader of Christendom in a great crusade for the protection of Constantinople. It is a melancholy spectacle that is offered to our view. The Eastern Empire, with its splendid traditions of past glories, has sunk to be a cat's paw in the ecclesiastical squabbles of the West. The trembling Greeks are ready to disavow their religious convictions to obtain help from their Western brethren. The states of Europe are so rent by intestine struggles, or are so bent upon purely selfish ends, that they are incapable of understanding the menace to European civilization contained in the establishment of the Turks on this side of the Bosphorus. The Greeks cannot appeal to any feeling of European patriotism or to any considerations of political wisdom. Only through the semblance of an ecclesiastical reconciliation can they hope to awaken any interest for their cause in Western Europe. At the last moment, they see the Western Church itself distracted by contending parties. They engage desperately in a sacrifice of their convictions, which they half feel will avail them nothing. End of section 39. Section 40 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 8, Eugenius IV in Florence, The Union of the Greek Church, 1434 to 1439, Part 2. The causes of the separation between the Eastern and Western churches were national rather than religious. The beliefs and rites of the two churches did not materially differ. But the political development of the East and West had been different. In the East, the imperial autocracy had maintained and strengthened its power over the church. In the West, where the Teutons had weakened the fabric of the imperial system, the Pope, as supreme head of the Western Church, had won an independent position for his authority. It is true that the Greek view of purgatory differed somewhat from that of the Latins, that they used leavened and not unleavened bread for the host, and that they did not adopt the addition of the words "and from the Son," filioque, to the clause of the Nicene Creed, which defines the procession of the Holy Ghost. But no vital point was concerned in any of these differences. The real disagreement was that the papacy strove to assert over the Eastern Church a supremacy which that church was unwilling to admit. The ill feeling created by the claim of Pope Nicholas I in 863 to interfere as supreme judge in the question of the election of the Patriarch of Constantinople simmered on till it produced a formal rupture in 1053 when Leo IX, at Hildebrand's suggestion, excommunicated the Greek patriarch. Round its ecclesiastical establishment, the narrow spirit of Greek nationality centered, and the Greeks were ready in every sphere to assert their superiority to the barbarous Latins. In the time of their distress, their pride was humbled if their minds were not convinced. They were ready to sacrifice the traditions of the past, which they still held firmly in their hearts, to the pressing need for present aid. It is sad to see the feeble representatives of an ancient civilization lowering themselves before the papacy in its abasement. On November 24, 1437, the Greek emperor, John Palaeologus, his brother the patriarch, and 22 bishops went on board the papal galleys and set sail for Italy. Though the Greeks journeyed at the pope's expense, yet the emperor, in his anxiety to display fitting magnificence, converted into money the treasures of the church. An earthquake which occurred at the time of his departure was looked upon as an evil omen by the people, who, with heavy hearts, saw the ships quit the harbor. After many perils and discomforts on the way, the Greeks reached Venice on February 8, 1438, and were magnificently received by the Doge, who went out to meet them in the Bucentaur, which was decked with red carpets and awnings wrought with gold embroidery, while gold lions were standing on the prow. The rowers were clad in uniforms richly wrought with gold, and on their caps was embroidered the image of St. Mark. With the Doge came the Senate in 12 other splendid ships, and there was such a multitude of boats that the sea could scarce be seen. Amid the clang of trumpets, the emperor was escorted to the palace of the Marquis of Ferrara near Rialto, where he abode. The amazement of the Greeks at the splendor of Venice is the most striking testimony to the decay of their own noble city. "Venice, splendid and great," says Franza, "truly wonderful, yea, most wonderful, rich, variegated, and golden, trimly built and adorned, worthy of a thousand praises, wise, yea, most wise, so that one would not be wrong in calling it the second land of promise." For 20 days the Greeks remained at Venice. The Doge offered them hospitality as long as they chose, and advised them to see whether they could get better terms from the Pope or from the Council. There was not much difference of opinion on this point. Three only of the Greek prelates thought it desirable to wait. The emperor's doubts, if he had any, were decided by the arrival of Cardinal Cesarini, who was the representative of that saner part of the council to which the Greeks professed to adhere. The stay of the Greeks in Venice was not without melancholy reflections. Wherever they turned, they were reminded that the glory of Venice was in a measure due to the spoils of Constantinople. In the rich jewels which bedecked the colossal statue on the high altar of St. Mark's, they saw the plunder of St. Sophia's. On February 28, 1438, the emperor set sail for Ferrara. The patriarch was sorely displeased at being left behind to follow in a few days. The emperor disembarked at Francolino, where he was received by the Marquis of Ferrara and Cardinal Albergata as the pope's legate. He entered the city on March 4th, riding on a magnificent black charger beneath a canopy held by his attendants. He advanced into the courtyard of the papal palace, where Eugenius IV was seated with all his clergy. The pope rose to greet the emperor, who dismounted and advanced. Eugenius prevented him from kneeling and embraced him. Then he gave him his hand, which the emperor kissed, and took his seat on the pope's left. They continued some time in friendly conference. The patriarch, who was particular to keep close to his luggage, followed grumbling and reached Ferrara on March 7th. His good humor was not increased by a message from the emperor telling him that the pope expected him to kiss his foot on his reception. This the patriarch stoutly refused to do. "I determined," he said, "if the pope were older than me, to treat him as a father, if of the same age as a brother, if younger as a son." He added that he had hoped by the pope's aid to free his church from the tyranny of the emperor, and could not subject it to the pope. The negotiations respecting this knotty question occupied the entire day. At last the pope, for the sake of peace, consented to waive his rights, provided the reception was in private, and only 6 of the Greek prelates were admitted at one time. On the evening of March 8th, the Patriarch Joseph, an old man of venerable aspect with white hair and a long white beard, of dignified bearing and considerable experience of affairs, greeted the Pope in his palace. The Pope rose and the Patriarch kissed his cheek, the inferior prelates his right hand. When the ceremony was over, they were conducted to their lodgings. The council had been opened at Ferrara on January 5th by the Cardinal Albergata as papal legate. Its first decree on January 10th, 1438, was to confirm the translation of the council from Basel to Ferrara, and to annul all that had been done at Basel since the Pope's bull of translation. On January 27th, the Pope entered Ferrara, escorted by the Marquis Nicholas III of Este. He took up his abode in the palace of the Marquis, and as he suffered grievously from gout, the citizens of Ferrara consulted his infirmity by erecting a wooden scaffold communicating between the palace and the cathedral, so as to spare him the inconvenience of mounting steps. On February 8th, he presided over a congregation and commended to its deliberation the work of union with the Greeks, and the repression of the excesses of those still remaining at Basel. The result of this deliberation was the issue of a bull on February 15th, annulling the proceedings of the Council of Basel, and declaring excommunicate all who did not quit it within 30 days. Eugenius IV had thus done all he could to affirm his dignity before the arrival of the Greeks. In like manner, the first point of importance with the Greeks was to affirm their own dignity at Ferrara. The question that first called for solution was the arrangement of seats in the council. Cesarini suggested that the Greeks should sit on one side of the cathedral, the Latins on the other, and the Pope in the middle as a link between the two parties. The Greeks bluntly answered that they needed no such link, but if a link were thought necessary, it should be strengthened by the addition of the Greek emperor and patriarch to the Pope. Both sides fought to win prestige, but the Greeks were not fighting on equal terms. They were the Pope's stipendiaries in Ferrara, and the arrangement for supplying them with the stipulated allowances went on side by side with the negotiations about the knotty question of seats. The Pope at first proposed to supply the Greeks with food. This they resisted and demanded an allowance in money. Ultimately, the Pope gave way. It was agreed that the Marquis of Ferrara should furnish them with lodgings, and the Pope give the Emperor 30 florins a month, the Patriarch 25, the prelates 4, and the other attendants 3. The Greeks accepted a compromise about seats. The Latins were to sit on one side, the Greeks on the other. The Pope's seat was highest and was nearest the altar. Next him was a vacant seat for the Western Emperor, opposite to which sat the Greek Emperor, and behind him the Patriarch. When the Patriarch wished to adorn his seat with curtains like the papal throne, he was not allowed to do so. The Greeks murmured at this arrangement, but were obliged to submit. The Emperor exclaimed that the Latins were not aiming at order, but were gratifying their own pride. Before appearing at the council, the Greek emperor insisted that it should not be merely an assembly of the prelates, but also of the kings and princes of the West. The Pope was driven to admit that some time was necessary before the princes could arrive. It was agreed that a delay of 4 months should take place to allow them to be duly summoned. Meanwhile, a general session should be held to proclaim that the council was to be held at Ferrara and nowhere else. Some time was spent in settling these matters. At last, on April 9th, a solemn session was held in the cathedral. A wonderful and awful sight, says a Greek. so that the church looked like heaven? The Pope and papal retinue chanted the psalm, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel." The patriarch was too ill to be present, but a declaration of his consent to the council was read in his absence. Then the decree convoking all to Ferrara within 4 months was read in Latin and Greek, and received the formal approval of both parties. After a few thanksgivings, the synod was dismissed. The festivities of Easter occupied some time, and the Greeks were annoyed that they could not get a church in Ferrara for the celebration of their own services. The Pope referred them to the Bishop of Ferrara, who answered that all his churches were so crowded that he could not find one large enough for their purposes. One of the Greeks said that he could not worship in the Latin churches, as they were full of saints whom he did not recognize. Even the Christ bore an inscription which he did not understand. He could only make the sign of the cross and adore that. The tone of mind exhibited in these remarks did not augur well for any real agreement, nor did the emperor wish the discussions to go too far. His plan was to defer matters as long as possible, to insist upon the council being representative of the powers of Europe, to obtain from them substantial help against the Turks, and to go back to Constantinople, having made as few concessions as were possible. The Latins, however, were anxious to make their triumph complete. They urged that it was a useless waste of time to do nothing while they waited for the appearance of the European princes. Cesarini displayed his wonted tact in inviting the Greeks to dinner and overcoming the reserve which the emperor wished them to maintain. He succeeded in inducing one of the most stubborn of the Greek prelates, Mark of Ephesus, to publish his views in writing, to the great wrath of the emperor. The papal officers were remiss in the payment of allowances, and hinted that the Pope could not continue to pay men who would do nothing. By such means the Greeks were at last driven to agree to the appointment of 10 commissioners on either side, who should engage in preliminary discussions upon the points of variance. Chief among the Greeks were Mark, Bishop of Ephesus, and Bessarion, Bishop of Nicaea. The emperor ordered that they only should conduct the discussions. On the side of the Latins, Cesarini took the leading part. The conferences began on June 4th. The first question discussed was that of purgatory, on which the real difference of opinion was not important. The Latins held that sins not repented of during life are purged away by purgatorial fire, which at the day of judgment is succeeded by everlasting fire for the reprobate. The Greeks admitted a purgatory, but of pain and grief, not of fire, which they reserved as the means only of eternal punishment. Also, the Greeks maintained that neither the punishment of the wicked nor the joy of the blessed was complete till the general resurrection, seeing that before that time neither could receive their bodies. The Latins admitted that the punishment of the wicked could not be perfect till they had received their bodies, but held that the blessed, as souls, enjoy at present perfect happiness in heaven, though on receiving their bodies their happiness would become eternal. Even the most staunch upholder of the Greek doctrines, Mark of Ephesus, was driven to admit that there was not much difference between the Greek and the Latin opinions on this question. When the discussion was ended, the Latins handed in their opinion in writing. The Greeks were timid in committing themselves. Each wrote his opinion and submitted it to the emperor, who combined those of Bessarion and Mark, to the effect that the souls of the happy departed, as souls, enjoy perfect felicity, but when in the resurrection they receive their bodies, they will be capable of more perfect happiness and will shine like the sun. On July 17th, this statement was submitted to the Latins. The only result of these conferences was to bring into prominence the differences existing amongst the Greeks themselves. The narrow and bigoted spirit of old Byzantine conservatism expressed by the rough, outspoken Mark of Ephesus, did not harmonize with the cosmopolitan feeling of the polished Platonist Bessarion, who saw the decadence of the Greeks and wished to bring his own ability into a larger sphere of literary and theological activity. The Latins learned that there were some amongst the Greeks who would bow, and some who must be driven to consent to union. Then came a pause till the 4 months' interval had elapsed for the fuller assembling of the council. None of the European princes appeared, and the delay continued. Ferrara was attacked by the plague. Some of the Greeks grew terrified or weary and fled home. The emperor requested the magistrates to keep guard over the gates, and forbade any of the Greeks to leave the city without his permission. The emperor, meanwhile, spent his time in hunting in the woods round Ferrara, and paid no heed to the requests of the marquis that he would spare his preserves, which had been stocked with great difficulty. The plague drove the Latins out of the city. Of 150 prelates who were present at the first session, only 5 cardinals and 50 bishops remained. The Greeks escaped the ravages of the plague, except only the household of the Russian archbishop. It was some time before the Pope could obtain the emperor's consent to a second session of the council. The Greeks were suspicious. They were indignant at a rumor which had been spread that they were guilty of 54 heresies. They were afraid that if they allowed the council to proceed, they might be outvoted. Their fears on this last point were set at rest by an agreement that each party should vote separately. After that, they could no longer resist the Pope's entreaties that the business of the council should proceed. On October 8th, the second session was held in the Pope's chapel, as Eugenius was unable to move through an attack of the gout. The Greeks had previously decided among themselves the question to be discussed. The more moderate party, headed by Bessarion, who was in favor of a real union, if it were possible, wished to proceed at once to the important point which divided the two churches, the double procession of the Holy Ghost. The Nicene Creed, which had been framed to define the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity, dealt chiefly with the relation between the Father and the Son, and contented itself with the statement that the Holy Ghost proceeded from the Father. The continuance of controversy in the West led to the addition of the words "and from the Son," filioque, an addition which the Greeks never made. The Western Church argued that the procession of the Holy Ghost from the Father alone derogated from the dignity of the Son, who was equal with the Father in all points, save only in his generation by the Father. The explanatory addition gradually became incorporated in the creed. The greater metaphysical instinct of the Greeks led them to reject such an addition, which seemed to them dangerous, as tending to give a double origin to the Holy Ghost, and thereby to imperil the unity in Trinity. There was no fundamental difference of opinion between the Greek and Latin fathers at first, but the genius of the Greek language admitted of finer distinctions than a Latin could comprehend. The Greeks were ready to allow that the Holy Ghost proceeded from the Father through the Son, not that he proceeded from the Father and the Son. The difference was of little moment, till the resentment of the Greek patriarch against the papal claims to supremacy led in the 9th century to an open rupture between the two churches, and every shadow of difference was at once brought into prominence. Tomes of learning had been amassed on either side in support of their opinions on this point, and a molehill had been piled to the height of a mountain. It was felt that this question presented the greatest difficulty in settlement. Bessarion and his followers wished to discuss it at once. Mark of Ephesus and those who were opposed to the union succeeded in overruling them, and proposed the more dangerous preliminary question, "Is it permissible to make any addition to a creed?" 6 disputants were chosen on either side. Bessarion, Mark, and Isidore of Russia were chief among the Greeks, Cardinals Cesarini and Albergata, and Andrea, Bishop of Rhodes, among the Latins. The arguments were long and the speeches were many on both sides. The fathers of Ferrara found, like the fathers of Basel, when dealing with the Bohemians, that a disputation led to little result. Speech was directed against speech. Orator refuted orator. But amid the flow of words, the central positions of the two parties remained the same. The Latins urged that the Filioque was an explanation of the Nicene Creed in accordance with the belief of most of the Latin and Greek fathers, notably St. Basil. The Greeks urged that it was not derived from the text of the creed itself, but was an unauthorized addition, which gave a careless explanation of a doctrine needing careful definition. Through October and November, the discussion rolled on. The monotony was only broken by the arrival of ambassadors from the Duke of Burgundy, who aroused the deepest indignation in the Greek emperor by paying reverence to the Pope and not to himself. When they urged that they were commissioned only to the Pope and had letters to him alone, the emperor was still more enraged and threatened to leave the council where he was subject to such slights. He could only be appeased by the solemn and public presentation of a letter forged by the ambassadors. The discussions were leading to no result. As a way of escaping from the mere strife of words, Cesarini besought that the real point of issue, the truth of the double procession of the Holy Ghost, be taken into consideration. If they were agreed that it was true, the addition of it to the creed was of small moment. The majority of the Greek prelates were loath to enter into a doctrinal discussion, but the rumors of a new Turkish attack on Constantinople made the emperor more desirous for succors. He assembled his prelates and said that it was unworthy of them, after so many labors and so much trouble, to refuse to come to the point. Their refusal in the present state of affairs would only give cause of triumph to the Latins. In vain the patriarch urged that it was unwise to quit the safe position of the unlawfulness of an addition to the creed. The emperor succeeded in extorting from the discordant prelates a reluctant consent to the discussion of the doctrine. The Pope, meanwhile, had been pressing on the emperor the necessity of transferring the council from Ferrara to Florence. He pleaded that at Ferrara he could get no money to fulfill his agreement with the Greeks. Niccolò Piccinino was ravaging the neighborhood, so that no revenues could reach the papal coffers. The plague had made Ferrara an unsafe place of residence. Florence had promised a large loan to the Pope if he would again take refuge within its walls. Eugenius IV was anxious to remove the Greeks further from their own land, to a place where they would be more entirely dependent on himself. The Greeks murmured, but their necessities gave them little option. As the Pope's stipendiaries, they were bound to go where he could best find them rations. On January 10, 1439, the last session was held at Ferrara and decreed the transference of the council to Florence on the ground of the pestilence. End of Section 40. Section 41 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 8, Eugenius IV in Florence, The Union of the Greek Church, 1434-1439, Part 3. On January 16, 1439, Eugenius IV left Ferrara for Florence. His journey was more like a flight before the troops of Piccinino than a papal progress. The sedentary Greeks were greatly wearied by the discomforts of a long journey across the Apennines in winter. The aged patriarch especially suffered from the journey, but his vanity was gratified by the splendor of his reception in Florence, where he was met by two cardinals, and amidst the blare of trumpets and the shouts of a vast multitude, he was escorted to his lodgings. 3 days after, on February 16th, arrived the emperor, but a storm of rain spoiled the magnificence of his reception and scattered the crowd which came to give him the welcome that the Florentines, better than any others, could give to a distinguished guest. In Florence, the Pope was determined to proceed more speedily with business than had been done at Ferrara. The Greek emperor had by this time seen the actual position of affairs. He was obliged to submit to the failure of the expectations with which he had come to Italy. He had hoped to play off the Council of Basel against the Pope, and so secure good terms for himself. He found the Latins united and undisturbed by the proceedings of the father still remaining at Basel. He hoped that the Western princes would have assembled at the council, and that he could have made the question of union secondary to a project for a crusade against the Turk. He found a purely ecclesiastical assembly which he could not divert from purely theological considerations. As he could not with dignity go back to Constantinople empty-handed, and as he sorely needed succors, he saw no other course open than to accept such terms of union as could be obtained, and trust afterwards to the generosity of Western Christendom. At Florence, he used his influence to expedite matters, and fell in with the Pope's suggestions for this purpose. On February 26th, a meeting took place at Florence in the Pope's palace, confined to 40 members on each side. It was agreed to hold public disputations 3 times a week for 3 hours at least, and also to appoint committees on each side, who might confer privately about the union. The public sessions, which began on March 2nd, were really a long theological duel between John of Montenegro, a famous Dominican theologian, and Mark of Ephesus. Day after day their strife went wearily on, diversified only by disputes about the authenticity of manuscripts of St. Basil against Eunomius, whose words Mark of Ephesus was convicted of quoting from a garbled manuscript. The argument turned on points verbal rather than real. Each side could support its own opinion more easily than prove the error of its opponent. Even Mark of Ephesus was wearied of talking, and in a long speech on March 17th fired his last shot. John of Montenegro on his part made a statement which the partisans of union among the Greeks seized as a possible basis for future negotiation. He said explicitly that the Latins recognized the Father as the one cause of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. This was the only theological point involved in the two positions. The emperor requested John to put his statement in writing and laid it before his assembled prelates. He spoke of all his labors to bring about union, and he urged them to accept this basis. The Greeks, in truth, were weary of the controversy. They longed to return home. The patriarch grew feebler day by day. The emperor grew more determined to see some fruits of all his trouble. A passage of a letter of St. Maximus, a Greek writer of the 7th century, was discovered by the Greeks, which agreed with the language of John of Montenegro. "If the Latins will accept this," exclaimed the partisans of the union, "what hinders us from agreement?" In an assembly of the Greek prelates, the emperor's will overbore all opposition, except that of Mark and the bishop of Heraclea. The letter of Maximus was submitted to the Latins as the basis for an agreement. Meanwhile, the public sessions were suspended. John of Montenegro, however, was anxious to have his reply to the last onslaught of Mark of Ephesus. Another session was held on March 21st to gratify the vanity of the Latins. But the emperor took the precaution of ordering Mark to absent himself. When thus bereft of an adversary, and listened to in solemn silence, John of Montenegro talked himself out in 2 days. An understanding had now been established between the Pope and the emperor, but the susceptibilities of the Greeks were still hard to manage. Public sessions, which only awakened vanity, were stopped. Committees composed of ardent partisans of the Union were nominated on both sides for the purpose of minimizing the difficulties that still remained. Bessarion and Isidore of Russia, among the Greeks, strove their utmost to overcome the rigid conservatism of their fellow countrymen. The cardinals Cesarini and Capranica, among the Latins, labored assiduously to secure the papal triumph. Perpetual messages passed between the Pope and the Emperor. Documents were drawn up on both sides. Proposals toward greater exactness of expression were put forward. Bessarion argued in a learned treatise that there was no real difference of meaning when the Latins said that the Holy Ghost proceeded from X, the Son, and the Greek fathers wrote that he proceeded through Dia, the Son. If both agreed that there were not two causes but one of the procession, and that the Father and the Son formed one substance. The patriarch was lying on his deathbed. Bessarion and his party were resolute for the union on large grounds of ecclesiastical statesmanship. Others of the Greeks, following the emperor, were convinced of its practical necessity. They had gone so far that they could not draw back. They were willing to seek out expressions of double meaning, which might serve for a compromise. Yet many of the Greeks held by the stubborn mark of Ephesus and would not give way. The discussion passed from being one between Greeks and Latins to one between two parties among the Greeks. Many were the fierce controversies, many the intrigues, great the anger of the emperor, before an end was visible to these troublesome disputations. At last, on June 3rd, the Greeks agreed that without departing from their ancient belief, they were ready to admit that the Holy Ghost proceeds from the Father and the Son as one cause and one substance, proceeds through the Son as the same nature and the same substance. Next day a schedule was drawn up, of which a copy was handed to the emperor, the pope, and the patriarch. It ran, "We agree with you and assent that your addition to the creed comes from the fathers. We agree with it and unite with you and say that the Holy Ghost proceeds from the Father and the Son as from one origin and cause." Matters had proceeded so far that the emperor turned to business and asked the pope what succors he would grant. Eugenius IV promised to supply 300 soldiers and 2 galleys for the constant defense of Constantinople, in time of need, 20 galleys for 6 months or 10 for a year. He also undertook to preach a crusade and rouse the West for the defense of the Greeks. Satisfied with this promise, the emperor hastened to bring matters to a conclusion. Mark of Ephesus was peremptorily ordered to hold his tongue, and he himself admits that he was not unwilling to be relieved from further responsibility in the matter. But the sudden death of the patriarch Joseph on the evening of June 10th seemed at first likely to put a stop to all further negotiations. The Greeks, bereft of their ecclesiastical head, might well urge that without his sanction all proceedings would be useless. Happily for Eugenius IV, there was found a paper subscribed by Joseph a few hours before his death, approving what seemed good to his spiritual sons and acknowledging the supremacy of the Roman Church. The patriarch was buried with due honors in the church of Santa Maria Novella, where the inscription on his tomb is the only memorial remaining to this day of the labor spent in uniting the Eastern and Western churches. Fortified by the patriarch's declaration, the emperor urged on the completion of the work of union. The pope submitted to the Greeks for their consideration the differences between the churches concerning the use of unleavened bread in the Eucharist, purgatory, the papal primacy, the words used in consecration. The pope had already laid before them a statement of the views which the Latins would be ready to accept. The only question was that those who were in favor of the union should win over the rest to accept the proffered terms. The subject of purgatory had already been threshed out at Ferrara, and the difference was seen to be slight. A satisfactory form of agreement was soon found. It was laid down that those who died in sin went to eternal punishment, those who had been purged by penitence went to heaven and beheld the face of God, those who died in penitence before they had produced worthy fruits of penitence for their omissions and commissions went to purgatory for purification by pains, and for them the prayers and alms of the faithful availed, as the Church ordained. The use of leavened or unleavened bread was a small point of ritual on which the Latins could urge that their own custom of using unleavened bread was more in accordance with the facts of the institution of the sacrament, as it was clear that at the time of the Passover Christ could only have unleavened bread. The Pope declared that though the Latin Church used unleavened bread, the sacrament might also be celebrated with leavened bread. The question was left open. As to the consecration of the elements, the Greeks were in the habit of using, after the words of consecration, a short prayer of St. Basil that the Spirit might make the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ. The Latins demanded that the Greeks should declare that the sacrament was consecrated only by the words of Christ. The Greeks did not doubt the fact, but objected to the declaration as unnecessary. It was agreed that it should be made verbally and not inserted in the Articles of Union. End of section 41. Section 42 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 2, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 3, Chapter 8. Eugenius IV in Florence, The Union of the Greek Church, 1434-1439, Part 4. So far, all went smoothly enough, but the greatest difficulty arose about the papal supremacy. Up to this point, the Greeks might flatter themselves that they had been making immaterial compromises or engaging in verbal explanations. Now they had to face the surrender of the independence of their church. However true it might be that they must make some sacrifices to gain political consideration, the recognition of the papal headship galled their pride to the quick. The Pope demanded that the Greeks should recognize him as the chief pontiff, successor of Peter, and vicar of Christ, and admit that he judged and ruled the church as its teacher and shepherd. The Greeks requested that their own privileges should be reserved. There was a stormy discussion. At length the Greeks, on June 22nd, proposed to admit the Pope's supremacy with two provisos. One, that the Pope should not convoke a council without the emperor and patriarch, though if they were summoned and did not come, the council might still be held. Two, that in case an appeal was made to the Pope against a patriarch, the Pope should send commissioners to investigate and decide on the spot, without summoning the patriarch to the council. Next day the Pope answered roundly that he intended to keep all his prerogatives, that he had the power of summoning a council when it was necessary, and that all patriarchs were subject to his will. On receiving this answer, the emperor angrily said, "See to our departure." It seemed that the negotiations were to be broken off, and that the Greeks would not give way. But next day, June 24th, being the festival of St. John Baptist, was given to religious ceremonies. The Greeks who had committed themselves to the Union, Bessarion, Isidore of Russia, and Dorotheus of Mytilene, spent the time in trying to arrange a compromise. Reflection brought greater calmness to the emperor, and on June 26th, Bessarion and his friends submitted a proposal couched in vaguer terms. "We recognize the Pope as sovereign pontiff, vice-regent and vicar of Christ, shepherd and teacher of all Christians, ruler of the Church of God, saving the privileges and rights of the patriarchs of the East. This was accepted by the Pope. Nothing now remained save to draw up in a general decree the various conclusions which had been reached. For this purpose, a committee of 12 was appointed, which labored for 8 days at the task. On July 4th, the decree was finished. When it was taken to the emperor, he objected to the fact that it ran in the Pope's name, in the usual style of an ecclesiastical decree, and he insisted on the addition of the words, "with the consent of the most serene emperor and patriarch of Constantinople." On July 5th, it was signed separately by the Latins and the Greeks. It bears the signature of 115 Latin prelates and abbots, and of 33 Greek ecclesiastics, of whom 18 were metropolitans. A great majority of the Greeks signed it unwillingly. Serapolis tells us of many machinations which were used to win their assent. On the one hand, the declared will of the emperor drove the compliant to submission. On the other hand, papal largesse was doled out to the needy, and social cajoleries were heaped upon the vain. Mark of Ephesus, alone of those who were at Florence, had the courage of his opinions and refused to sign. He was too considerable a person to be intimidated by the emperor, and too stubborn a conservative to be won over by the Pope. In spite, however, of the pathetic account of Serapolis, it is difficult to feel much sympathy with the reluctant Greeks. They knew, or they might have known, when they left their homes, what they had to expect. It was a question of political expediency, whether or not it was desirable in their imminent peril to abandon their attitude of isolation and seek a place amid the nations of Western Christendom. If so, they must expect to make some sacrifice of their ancient independence, to overthrow some of the walls of partition which their conservatism had erected between themselves and the Latin Church. An acknowledgement of the papal supremacy was the necessary price for papal aid. It was useless to appear as beggars and demand to retain all the privileges of independence. It was useless to advance so far on rational calculations of expediency and to raise objections the moment that the actual pinch was felt by national vanity. The wisest heads among the Greeks confessed that since the Greek church was no longer the center of a vigorous national life, it must conform in some degree to the Latin church if the Greeks looked for aid to the Latin nations. Moreover, the circumstances of the time were such that the Pope was as anxious for the union as were the Greeks themselves. The Latins were willing to accept vague conditions and to agree readily to compromises. The Greeks could not complain that they were hardly pressed in matters of detail. On July 6th, the publication of the decrees took place in the stately cathedral of Florence. The Greeks had at least the satisfaction of outdoing the Latins in the splendor of their vestments. The Pope sang the Mass. The Latin choir sang hymns of praise, but the Greeks thought their Gregorian music barbarous and inharmonious. When they had ended, the Greeks sang their hymns in turn. Cesarini read the union decree in Latin and Bessarion in Greek. Then the two prelates embraced one another as a symbol of the act in which they had engaged. Next day the Greeks, who had been spectators of the Latin Mass, asked that the Pope should in like manner be present at the celebration of their Mass. They were told that the Pope was not certain what their Mass was, and would like to see it performed privately before he committed himself to be present at a public ceremony. The Greeks refused to subject themselves to this supervision. The emperor said indignantly that they had hoped to reform the Latins, but it seemed that the Latins only intended to reform them. The Greeks were now anxious to depart, but waited to receive from the Pope 5 months' arrears of their allowance. The Pope tried to raise some other questions for discussion, chief of which was divorce, which the Greek church allowed, while the Latin church did not. he suggested that they should at once proceed to the election of a patriarch. The emperor refused any further discussion and said that they would proceed to elect a patriarch on their return, according to their own customs. The pope requested that Mark of Ephesus should be punished for his contumacy, but this also the emperor wisely refused. To make assurance doubly sure, the pope demanded that 5 copies of the union decree should be signed by the original signatories, 1 for the Greeks, the rest to be sent to the princes of Europe. The Greeks objected that this was unnecessary. At last, however, they agreed to sign 4 duplicates, on the understanding that no further difficulties were to be put in the way of their departure. On July 20th, the Greek prelates began to quit Florence. The emperor remained till August 26th, when he made his way to Venice, and returned to Constantinople after an absence of 2 years. "Have you won a triumph over the Latins?" was the question eagerly asked of the returning prelates. "We have made a satisfactory compromise," was the general answer. "We have become Azymites," so the Latins were called by the Greeks, because they used unleavened bread in the mass. "We have become Azymites and betrayed our creed," said Mark of Ephesus, and the Greek people took his view of the matter. They were profoundly conservative, and though their leaders might see the necessity of departing from their national isolation, the people could not be induced to follow the new policy. The Greek prelates who at Florence had unwillingly accepted the union could not stand against the popular prejudice, and by their excuses for what they had done only tended to inflame the popular wrath. Mark of Ephesus became a hero. The prelates who had wished for the union were treated with contumely. The emperor was powerless. The bishop of Cizicum, whom he made patriarch, was looked upon with aversion as a traitor. When he gave the people his blessing, many of them turned away, that they might not be defiled by one tainted with the leprosy of Latinism. The emperor, finding that he could do nothing to abate the force of this popular feeling, adopted an attitude of indifference. The pope supplied for the defense of Constantinople 2 galleys and 300 soldiers, as he had promised, but no great expedition was equipped by Europe against the Turks. The emperor's brother Demetrius, despot of Epirus, who had been with him in Italy, and had been a spectator of all that had there been done, actually ventured to raise a rebellion. He combined Turkish aid with the fanatical feeling of the extreme Greek party against the Latins, and for a time troubled his brother. The 3 patriarchs of Jerusalem, Antioch, and Alexandria issued in 1443 an encyclical letter in which they condemned the Council of Florence as a council of robbers and declared the Patriarch of Constantinople a matricide and heretic. Thus the Council of Florence was productive of no direct fruits. The popes did not succeed in establishing their supremacy over the Greek church. The Greeks got no substantial aid from Western Christendom to enable them to drive away their Turkish assailants. Yet the Council of Florence was not utterly useless. The meeting of 2 different civilizations and schools of thought gave a decided impulse to the literary world of Italy, and attracted thither some of the leaders of Greek letters. It was not long before Gemistus Platho took up his abode in Florence, and Bessarion became a cardinal of the Roman Church. Greek letters found a home in the West, and when the impending destruction at last fell upon Constantinople, the Greek exiles found a refuge prepared for them by their fellow countrymen. To Eugenius IV and to the papacy, the Council of Florence rendered a signal service. However slight its ultimate results might be, it was the first event since the outbreak of the schism which restored the ruined prestige of the papacy. Public opinion is naturally influenced chiefly by accomplished facts. No one could judge of the permanence of the work. but all were in some measure impressed by a new sense of the papal dignity when they heard that, downcast as he was, Eugenius IV had still succeeded in healing the schism which had so long rent asunder the Christian Church. The Pope, whose name was loaded with obloquy at Basel, had been accepted as supreme at Constantinople. The power which was hard-pressed at Rome still had sufficient vigor to win new conquests abroad. With lofty exultation, Eugenius IV wrote to the Prince of Christendom and announced the success of his efforts. He recapitulated his labors in this holy cause, carried on in spite of many discouragements, because he knew that only in Italy and only in the presence of the Pope could this great result be obtained. It was a home thrust which the fathers of Basel would find it hard to parry. The Council of Florence was felt to be a triumph of papal diplomacy. The prospect of it had drawn from Basel all men possessed of any moderation. The Italians saw in it the means of reasserting their hold on the headship of the Church, which the Transalpine nations had begun to threaten. In union with the Greeks, they saw the beginning of a new epoch of crusades, in which the papacy might again stand forth as the leader of the Latin race. The acute statesman and learned scholar Francisco Barbaro, who was at that time Capitano of Brescia, wrote to the Archbishop of Florence at the beginning of the council, pointing out the means to be employed. Learning and argument, he said, were useless, for the Greeks were too acute and too proud of their knowledge to be overcome by disputation. They must be treated with tact and with kindness. They must be led to see that in union lie their safety and glory. He urged the necessity of the greatest care. The union must be made to succeed. Otherwise, there was no chance for the papacy, and Italian affairs would be plunged into hopeless confusion. The policy recommended by Barbaro was that pursued by the Pope's advisers. Cesarini's experience at Basel had fitted him admirably for the work to be done at Florence. The papal diplomacy won a signal triumph, and followed up its first victory by others, less conspicuous indeed, but which added strength to the papal cause. In December 1439, the reconciliation of the Armenians to the Roman Church was announced to Europe, and Jacobites, Syrians, Chaldeans, and Maronites, in succeeding years, made illusory submission, which served to present a dazzling display of papal power. End of section 42. Read by Pamela Nagami, M.D., in Encino, California, February 2024. End of A History of the Papacy from the Great Schism to the Sack of Rome, Volume 2, by Mandel Creighton.